Just a few administrative notes before we begin. First, could you please turn off all cell phones and other similar sorts of devices? I'm told that BlackBerries are particularly important to be turned off, because if you start receiving email during the course of the movie, it interferes with the sound system, or might interfere with the sound system. So if you could turn those off, I'd appreciate it. The restrooms are outside, just past the elevators. Can everyone see all right? It may be helpful if some of the taller people could move to the outside and leave the shorter people in the center of the room. That for a future reference, if not for now. Also, the people sitting next to the air conditioners are off, are they? Oh, okay. That's already done then. Okay. Very good. As you can see, there's a lot of interest for tonight's movie, and the subsequent weeks, 8 weeks of the series are already filling up, so if you haven't already, please do register for any future of these 8 movies that you'd like to attend as soon as possible. You can do this at the EPPC website by visiting eppc.org/romance or /romance/movie. The general order of events for tonight, I'll say a few words. We'll watch the movie, which is about an hour and 45 minutes long. We'll have no more than a 5-minute break to rearrange the room, and then we'll begin tonight's discussion, which, as it was on last year's and during last year's movies, will be led by Leon and Amy Cass, who we're very happy to have back with us. And by an amazing coincidence, they have written a book on the subject of romance, which I highly recommend to all of you. welcome all of you who have come back for more after last year's series especially. This year's theme, as you will all know by now, is the movie Romance. It's still mostly American. Last year's was the American movie Hero. This is still largely the American movie Romance, but it has one British film. And as I see it, it follows on naturally from the heroic theme of last year's series. This is partly because, historically, romance and heroism were intimately connected. The earliest romances had to do with the love lives of the heroes, of the particularly the knights of the Round Table, like Lancelot, Gawain, Yvain, and others, because love, like honor, was thought to be appropriate to the knightly and aristocratic social classes. We shall see vestigial evidence of the same assumption in several of this year's films, including the one we're showing this evening, which is Frank Capra's It Happened One Night, even though the romance here has obviously come a long way from its medieval origins. Romantic love is, like the masculine sense of honor that was common to so many of last year's heroes, a Western invention, born of the Christian tradition. Just as Christianity's adversarial stance versus the traditional honor culture, at the heart of which was enshrined the vendetta, created a new sort of gentlemanly honor, so the Judeo-Christian tradition of monogamy created the medieval European romance and the long line of romantic fiction which has grown out of it. Monogamy, of course, means exclusion, and exclusion is more likely to lead to tragedy than comedy, or so you might think. Certainly the greatest of the love stories from the early days of romance in the Middle Ages, those of Tristan and Isolde and Lancelot and Guinevere, were both tragic and adulterous. The greatest English romance of the Middle Ages, Geoffrey Chaucer's Troilus and Cressida, was also tragic. Even the romantic comedies of Shakespeare have an edge of sadness to them, a sense that the love and happiness at the very end of them are torn at the last minute, often by some ridiculous chance from the very teeth of despair. There was, when I was a student, quite a controversy over C.S. Lewis's contention in his first and most influential literary book, The Allegory of Love, that what he called courtly love always had to be adulterous. Later scholars insisted that Lewis had made the mistake of taking Andreas Capellanus, author of a 12th century text called De Amore, too seriously and of failing to recognize that Andreas is insisting on the lovers loving only someone other than a spouse, was ironic. It always seemed to me that if it was ironic, that would tend to reinforce Lewis's point, since making fun of such a notion would have meant that the idea of love as inevitably adulterous was much more widespread than just Andreas's little tongue-in-cheek guide. In any case, I don't think there can be much doubt that love, like honor, was for a long time seen as an aristocratic pastime and had not very much to do with the institution of marriage, except insofar as sometimes the wedding that took place at the end of a series of romantic adventures was conventionally taken to be the image of earthly felicity, happily ever after, as the fairy tales put it. But Shakespearean comedy also provides a foreshadowing of what was to become, in the revolutionary 18th century, the domestic romance that was the product of the simultaneous rise of the novel and of the middle classes. What is often taken to be the earliest English novel, Samuel Richardson's Pamela, became the sensation of the 1740s by telling the story of a poor but honest maidservant who becomes the victim of an aristocratic sexual predator, her employer, and ends by becoming his wife. It was a great tribute to the principle of virtue rewarded, to use Richardson's subtitle, and to the belief that was to hold such sway for the next two centuries that it was by saying no to male sexual importunity that the good girl of humble background could finally win her way to happiness as a wife in her own home rather than a mistress in somebody else's. It must have seemed quite a progressive, even a feminist idea at the time. Now, it was not just the wedding, but what we have learned since called the bourgeois marriage and the establishment of a new household, which served as the image of human happiness. And this idea was still very close to the heart of the popular culture right down to the age of the talking cinema. As I say, there is just the hint of the class origins of the domestic romance in It Happened One Night. Claudette Colbert plays Ellie Andrews, the spoiled daughter of a fabulously wealthy father, played by Walter Connolly, who rebels against his wishes in choosing to marry a young man of whom he disapproves. The overtones of aristocratic tradition, of dynastic and arranged marriages, and of women as the property of their fathers are all present in this scenario, but only to be mixed up and confounded. For the young man is disapproved of not on the grounds that he's unsuitable for dynastic purposes, but that he is, but because the wise old dad really does know better than his daughter that the playboy, aviator, and celebrity King Wesley, played by Jameson Thomas, is a phony and won't make her happy. I just love the wonderfully American political incorrectness of this idea. Old man Andrews could so easily have been a caricature villain to a more ideologically minded filmmaker than Frank Capra, an oppressor of the workers and a domestic tyrant. But his worst sin seems to be the one that he is accused of by Peter Warne, the déclassé journalist played by Clark Gable, which is that he has pampered and spoiled his daughter to the point at which she feels she must rebel against him. Yet, it is once again the patriarch who is the first to see that Warne, this man of the people who professes to despise him and all his class, you, King Wesley, your father, you're all a lot of hooey to me, he tells Ellie, is the one who will make his daughter happy and actually proposes an elopement with him in the middle of her wedding to Wesley. It's worth remembering that this film dates from the depths of the Depression, 1934, the same year in which the Hays Code, Hollywood's 30-year-long experiment in self-regulation in response to complaints of immorality in the movies, was instituted. It should also be seen in connection with the coming of the Roosevelt administration and the repeal of Prohibition the year before. The high living and sexual experimentation that had been characteristic of the jazz age of the 1920s, or at least of the stories it told itself, was now getting something of a rethink at the same time that so many of that decade's nouveau riche were being brought down to earth with a bump. The conventional wisdom holds that this was a period when people went to the movies looking for escape from the hardships of their daily lives, and that is why so many pictures from those years have happy endings and deal, as this one does, with life among the rich. Rich people, or people like to imagine themselves as part of this rich world, this world of glitz and sophistication, because their own lives were so very different. That's how the thesis goes. I have my doubts about it, however. Escape of one sort or another has been characteristic of the movie's allure throughout their history, and if by escape we mean to imply that the world audiences are escaping to is unreal, it is at least arguably more characteristic of the comic book fantasies of our own time than it is of moral dramas like It Happened One Night, or most of the other romances of the 1930s and 40s. Ellie Andrews may have been an heiress, but the moral choices she confronts would have been familiar ones to her audience. Frank Capra subtly but frequently reminds us of the backdrop of the Depression against which his reverse Cinderella story takes place. Clark Gable, for instance, is first introduced to us in the process of throwing away a job, something that must have seemed almost lunatic folly to the original audience, while drunk and telling off his employer. Yet he was also reminding them that this, too, is part of the American dream, the sense of self-respect and self-sufficiency that allows us to tell the boss to take this job and shove it. In a way, it is the American dream. Such quixotic bravado puts us on notice that here is a free man with a masculine confidence that he will always be able to make his way in the world. It's only when he begins to think of the plans that he shyly admits to Ellie on their last night together that he has been sucker enough to make, that he joins the many men before and since who have been induced to take up a life of adult responsibility by the love of